time once again for Community Forum, and we're very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning Sandy Doughton. Sandy Doughton is the science writer at the Seattle Times and a board member of the Northwest Science Writers Association. Her 20 years of covering science, environment, health, and medicine include work at the Los Alamos Monitor, the Santa Fe New Mexican, and the Tacoma News Tribune. And she is here to talk about her new book, Full Rip 9.0, The Next Big Earthquake in the Pacific Northwest. Sandy, thank you very much for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
So start out, tell us, what was your motivation in writing Full Rip 9.0?
Well, I've been covering earthquakes and seismic research in the Pacific Northwest for about 20 years now. And I think a lot of people do not realize just how dramatically our understanding of the earthquake risk we face here has changed during that time. It's really been only in the past 20 or 30 years that we have come to realize that we're subject to the biggest earthquakes and tsunamis in the world here. And so it just seemed like a good time to kind of pull that history together and you know, take a look ahead at what we can expect in the future.
All right. So tell us, when was it, you said 20 or 30 years, when was it specifically when we started realizing that we might be in a bit of trouble?
Well, for a long time, ever since white settlers arrived here and started moving here in the 1850s or so, the kind of conventional wisdom about the Northwest, Washington, Oregon, British Columbia, was that, you know, we get an occasional small earthquake, but nothing big, and thank God we're not as bad as California. And it was really during the 60s and the 70s with the development of plate tectonics that people came to realize that there is a massive fault off the coast here that runs from 700 miles from the northern end of Vancouver Island to Cape Mendocino, California. And this fault represents the place where the tectonic plate that makes up the seafloor meets the North American continent. And when two tectonic plates meet, something has to give. And so what happens is that the seafloor dives under the continent or subducts under the continent. So this is called a subduction zone. So it was, by the early 70s, people realized this fault was there. And in other places around the world, these are the kinds of faults that generate the biggest earthquakes and tsunamis. And this is the type of fault that snapped off Japan a couple of years ago and was responsible for the devastation there. But for a long time, people just felt that there was something different about this one off the coast of the Northwest called the Cascadia subduction zone. They just thought that it had, petered out, run out of steam, or was somehow or other aseismic, that it couldn't generate earthquakes.
And from your reading of your book, it was a gentleman, Tom Heaton, working on WHOOPS, mm-hmm. that started doing some of the initial most recent research on this.
Yeah, this WHOOPS, the Washington Public Power Supply System, was an effort, back in the 70s and 80s to build five nuclear power plants in the Northwest. And at that time, enthusiasm for nuclear power was just huge in this region. And at one time, there were, 10 or so power plants on the drawing board, including a couple just north of Seattle on the Skagit River. And it was really the plans to build these plants that got people re-examining the seismic risk here in this region. And in particular, WHOOPS wanted to build a couple of plants out toward the Washington coast at a place called Satsop. And if you drive from Olympia to the coast today, you can still see the cooling towers from those two plants. They were largely constructed, but never operated. The people who were WHOOPS and the proponents of these plants sort of made the same assumption that everyone else was doing at the time, which was that the worst earthquakes we could get were the kinds that had happened in 1965, 1949, and similar to the 2001 Nisqually quake. These are deep quakes, and, they can be sizable, but they're not that damaging in general because they're deep underground. And so they just sort of assumed that this fault off the coast was not going to be a problem for their nuclear power plant near the coast. the Nuclear Regulatory Commission asked USGS scientist Tom Heaton to come in and take another look at that. So he was really kind of the first to critically, examine what was known about this fault off the coast and to compare it to other subduction zones around the world. And what he concluded is, hey, there's no reason to assume we couldn't get a big quake here just because we haven't had one in the last 150 years or so.
And he was pretty much challenging the conventional thought at that time. Sorry.
He was, yeah. There was a lot of debate and discussion among geologists at that time, but the conventional wisdom was that this subduction zone off the coast was harmless, that it could not generate big earthquakes. And Heaton said, hey, there's no reason to think that. But at that time, there was no evidence that there had been any past earthquakes. And it was only in the next few years that another USGS scientist, Brian Atwater, started poking around out on the coast looking for evidence. And he was the one who found the first evidence that there had been giant quakes and tsunamis here in the past.
We'll talk more about his work and how he discovered that there had been significant earthquakes in the past.
Yeah, well, he's Brian's a very interesting scientist, not the least of which because he was not an expert in earthquakes when he started doing this work. He was a guy who had studied mudflats down in San Francisco. But he knew that, by looking at these mud layers on the coast, these marshes and low-lying areas on the coast, you could find out if the ground level had changed in the past. And so that's what he did, going out to the Washington coast, starting up at Nea Bay, digging into marshes and riverbanks and looking for evidence that the land had dropped in the past. Because when the geologic plates at a subduction zone are locked up tight, building to an earthquake, the coastline bulges upward. And when things reach the breaking point and the plates snap and you get the earthquake, the bulge flattens out, so the ground along the coast drops. And what Brian found digging in these marshes were layers of soil that had once been at the surface and had dropped, 3 to 6 feet in places. And then gradually new soil would come in and build up over the years. And then boom, something would happen and it would drop again. So he found these bands of buried soil, each one representing a great earthquake in the past. And then he also found in many areas layers of sand that could only have been washed in from a tsunami. So this was the first evidence that, hey, it's happened here before, and one thing geologists understand that the rest of us really don't grasp in a visceral way is that if it's happened before, it's going to happen again.
So from his work, it sounded like there are, similar to like rings on a tree, there are, if you cut into the side of a river, there are these layers that give a history as well.
Yeah, that's correct. And in some places, he found, 6 or 7 of these layers, one on top of the other, fainter going back further in time. But and eventually he and others up and down the coast were able to put together, a history going back several thousand years and finding evidence of at least 19 of these, very powerful quakes and tsunamis in the last 10,000 years.
So he was one of the things people were trying to get out of him once they discovered his work was if he could nail down a specific years that these occurred. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, well, one of the things that since you can't predict earthquakes, about the best that can be done is to understand, the history of a fault, how many quakes it's produced in the past, how big they are, and then you can get a general idea of how frequent the quakes might be. And of course, people were very, very interested in the most recent of these giant quakes to figure out when that happened. And this is, really one of the most amazing detective stories in the field of geology, is how Brian and his colleagues were able to pin down an exact date and time of the last quake, the last big subduction zone quake here in the Pacific Northwest. And they did it in a number of ways. They already had, from carbon dating, you know, bits of plant and tree roots and stuff from these buried soil layers, they had a general idea that, you know, that this quake struck sometime between, say, 1600 and the end of the 1700s. So they had narrowed it down to that sort of window of time. And back then, of course, there were people here in the Northwest, the Native Americans and the First Nations people up in Canada, but they didn't have a written language. So even though later on people realized, or, you know, outsiders, I guess the Native Americans knew this for a long time, that they had these stories passed down about big quakes and strange waves. At the time, you know, there was no written record of that. So a scientist in Japan, a tsunami expert, began to wonder whether, you know, if there had been a big quake in off the coast of North America several hundred years ago, and if it was big enough, the tsunami would have crossed the ocean and hit Japan. And we saw this in 2011 when the tsunami from the huge Japanese quake crossed the Pacific and hit the coast of North America in the Pacific Northwest. Now, it didn't amount to much in Washington and Oregon, but in California, Crescent City, it did quite a bit of damage, and actually one person was killed. So this Japanese scientist figured that if there had been a strange tsunami in Japan several hundred years ago, people would have noticed it. And the Japanese have been keeping records of earthquakes for almost 1,000 years. So he and some of his colleagues started going through these old Japanese records. And indeed, they found several reports from cities, towns along the coast that, you know, on this winter's night in the year 1700, strange waves started surging onto the shore, and villages were flooded, a ship was swamped, and they didn't know what to make of it because it was like a tsunami, but there hadn't been any ground shaking because, of course, the earthquake was on the other side of the ocean. And so using this information from the Japanese reports and then computer models of what that tsunami would have been like, how long it would have taken to cross the ocean, they were able to pin down the exact date and time. So we know now that our last full Rip 9 quake struck on January 26th, 1700 at 9 p.m.
And wasn't there also a parallel work being done with actual tree rings that scientists were
working on? Yeah, that's true. So another bit of confirmation came from a place out on the Washington coast called the Ghost Forest of the Copalis. And this is a place, this is an area, a stand of old cedar trees that were there in 1700 when the ground suddenly dropped out from under them during this quake, and seawater flooded in, and so the trees were killed. Now, they were so, the standing trunks, which are still there, were so worn away that it was really hard to get an accurate date for when they were killed because the outer rings were gone. But Brian Atwater and his colleague Dave Yamaguchi figured out that if they dug into the ground, they could extract roots from these old cedar trees. And from those roots, they were able to confirm that those trees died in the winter of 1700. So that was another piece of evidence verifying this date.
And as well, you also included oral histories from different native tribes up and down the coast, including mm-hmm. the Macaw.
Yeah, there's just some amazing stories and legends. Some are more fanciful than others. You know, more abstract. There are a lot of the Native Americans talk about these, you know, epic battles between the Thunderbird and the whale, representing earth and sea. And one particular story talks about the you know, the Thunderbird, you know, grabbing the whale and dropping it on the land. And a lot of people interpret this as being, you know, the story of a tsunami. And there are also, you know, more literal stories that were passed down through, you know, generation after generation in Native American oral history that tell of specific places that were wiped out. And, you know, the rough dates that those stories yield fall in this same time period. So that's another piece of evidence confirming that something pretty bad happened here about 300 years ago.
So we know that this, we now know then that this mega quake happened 300 years ago. So then I guess the next question is what do they anticipate is the spread on when these quakes occur?
Yeah. The thing is, you know, like I said, the best you can do is sort of, you know, in terms of forecasting what's going to happen is look at what's happened in the past. And so today there is evidence for, you know, at least 19 of these big quakes, full rip nines in the last 10,000 years. And a full rip quake is one that rips the entire length of the subduction zone. And when that happens, you get at least a magnitude 9 quake. So we're talking big. There's also newer evidence that there have been partial rip earthquakes, about 23, 24 of those in that same period, that seem to break mainly the southern part of the subduction zone, and these would generate earthquakes of about magnitude 8, which would still be a very, very powerful earthquake, you know, bigger than anything we've seen in the United States in historic times, except for the 1964 quake in Alaska. So when you put those all together, you come up with an average recurrence interval of about 250 to 300 years. And it's been 313 years since the last one. Now, you know, it's those kinds of records are not, they don't give you, you know, absolute predictions because the intervals between the quakes vary so widely. And there's no way of knowing, you know, if you know, the next one's going to happen tomorrow or it's going to happen in another 200 years. There's that much variation. But we do know it's coming.
And since we do know it's coming, what have our elected officials and what are people doing to mitigate that?
Well, it's, you know, it's only been since the 1990s that our building codes were updated to take into account the fact that we get these huge quakes. And, you know, about half of the high-rise buildings in the Northwest, Vancouver, Seattle, Portland, Tacoma, were all built before that. Now, today's building codes are much better, but we have a lot of old building stock out there. And one thing the city of Seattle is doing to address this is focusing on the buildings that are the highest risk, and these are the old brick buildings, which are, you know, all over the region. And unlike in California, there has been no requirement here that those things be retrofitted. So really, most of them have not been. So the city of Seattle has put together an inventory of more than 800 of these old brick buildings here in Seattle. And if you're interested, you can find it online at the City of Seattle. It's listed under unreinforced masonry. And there's just a list. You can go down by address. And if you live or work in one of those buildings, you know, you probably don't own the building, but you should put pressure on the person who owns the building to upgrade that, or at least, you know, make yourself aware of your risk. But what the city of Seattle is moving slowly toward a requirement that would mandate retrofits for buildings like this. But it's something that's going to be, you know, phased in slowly over time. But that is a big step forward. the Washington Department of Transportation has put together an inventory of bridges across the state and has fixed up about half of them. But there are, you know, more than 1,000, several thousand more that have yet to be fixed. They're slowly working their way through it. It's, you know, this is very expensive stuff and it takes a long time. But, you know, if we don't start doing it now, it won't get done.
And not to mention the incredible amount of infrastructure we're all come to be to take for granted and be dependent on, electricity, gas, water, you name it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, imagine, you know, having to line up to use porta potties for 6 months after a big earthquake, or, you know, having to line up at water trucks to, you know, to carry home gallon jugs of water after one of these quakes. And that's a very realistic scenario because, you know, the pipes that carry the water, the pipes that carry the sewage, pipes that carry natural gas and fossil fuels, a lot of those, you know, run through areas where the soil is going to just liquefy during one of these big quakes. And as a result, those pipes are going to get broken. And it can take a long time, a very long time to fix. In both Washington and Oregon, emergency preparedness people, geologists, engineers have collaborated on what they call resilience plans. And these are, you know, 50-year roadmaps for what we need to do in terms of upgrading this infrastructure that, like you said, we all rely on, we all take for granted, and we really, you know, the region couldn't survive without it. And they're, you know, putting these out there for the state legislatures to act on. And Oregon is really getting some traction on its plan because they have a lot of interested lawmakers there. Here in Washington, it's not doing so well because there's no champion in the legislature to really bring it forward. But irrespective of that, you know, people around the state are now starting to think about these things. They're starting to, you know, work with private companies, you know, the companies that that provide our internet service, the utilities that provide power, you know, the refineries that create our fossil fuels, you know, to think about, you know, what we can do to reduce the impact and to reduce the amount of time following one of these quakes that these services are down. And you know, the fear is this kind of quake and tsunami could be the biggest natural disaster the United States has ever seen. And if, you know, if it takes years and years and years for things to get back to normal, then the economy of the Northwest could just spiral down. And, you know, you could have a situation where there's just like a lost generation here. So this is something we really need to start thinking about now.
Again, you said it's the Cascade reduction zone.
The Cascadia subduction zone is the name of this big fault off the coast.
750 miles long?
So, yeah, 750 miles long. And it's also subduction zones. The rule of thumb in earthquakes is the bigger the fault, the bigger the quake. And subduction zones are by far the biggest faults on the planet, not only by virtue of their length, but by the fact that they, you know, they represent a place where two tectonic plates are grinding past each other. So there's a huge surface area involved. And in between quakes, you know, these plates get locked tight. They get stuck together. And, you know, when things reach the breaking point, boom, that's when you get the quake. And when that happens, the surface area that moves can be just immense. I did a calculation. I still can't believe it, but I checked it out that in one of these quakes, you can have these plates moving across an area as big as the state of Maine. So this is just a huge area of earth moving, and you know, therefore just unleashing an incredible, incredible amount of power. And it's the motion of those plates offshore that causes the tsunami, because you get this breaking and the edge of one plate flips up and that lifts the water column and sends it hurtling toward the shore.
But we're talking about, because I think a lot of people would imagine just the city of Seattle being, you know, devastated by this, but it sounds like we're talking about pretty much from Vancouver down to Portland being
correct.
Wiped out.
So that's one of the things that is so different about this kind of a quake, is that it can potentially affect such a huge area. So, you know, normally if we got a bad quake here in Seattle, we could turn to Portland, we could turn to Vancouver for help, but nobody's going to be able to help us, nobody nearby, after, you know, this big quake, because the whole region is going to be, you know, in a world of hurt.
Only a few minutes left. And it would just be the West Coast. Would Eastern Washington, for instance, Hanford, where they have lots of highly radioactive volatile material there, would that be affected by this?
Not so much. It's, you know, the intensity of the shaking reduces the further away you are from the area of the fault that ruptures. You know, they will definitely feel it in Eastern Washington and Eastern Oregon, but the amount of damage there is going to be very slight compared to what we see over here on the coast and in the Western Washington, Western Oregon areas.
Okay. And, real quickly, because we only got about 2 minutes left. In addition to this major fault line, then Seattle has its own faults.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that briefly?
That's correct. Here in the Northwest, we're actually subject to three different kinds of earthquakes. We hit the jackpot. We have these big coastal megaquakes. Then we have deep quakes, like the ones I mentioned earlier that occurred in 65, 49, and 2001. And then the same tectonic forces that are squeezing the region and setting us up for these big quakes also create shallow faults. And these are California-style faults, like the San Andreas, only not quite as, you know, we don't see them on the surface like they do in California. But one of those runs right under Seattle, the Seattle Fault. And we know that that last broke about 1,100 years ago, and that was a hell of a quake that, you know, thrust coastlines up into the air and caused a huge tsunami in Puget Sound.
So, and that one's a little, if it was 1,000 years ago, then probably a big one like that won't happen in our lifetime, but we don't know.
Probably not. If we're lucky, it won't, but we don't know. A quake very, very like that hit Christchurch, New Zealand a couple of years ago, and they had no inkling that they could get anything like that. At least we know here that it's possible.
But it sounds like the Cascadia subduction zone is a reasonable chance that it still could happen in our lifetime.
It could. I mean, it could happen in our lifetime. It could happen in our grandchildren's lifetime. You know, once again, the time frame is so variable that it's hard to say. But the thing that we can say is that there's a 100% chance that it will happen.
All right. We're talking with Sandy Doughton. She is science writer at the Seattle Times and author of the new book, Full Rip 9.0, The Next Big Earthquake in the Pacific Northwest. And do you have a website?
I do not.
Okay. Then people just have to go to the book. It's a good read and quickly pulls you through towards how bad things are. So with that, we are unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you very much for coming and spending time with us this morning.
My pleasure to be here.